From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1976 in a rather obscure scholarly article. The article, written about women celebrated in Puritan funeral sermons. So as I said, maybe a little obscure. But the opening paragraph of that article contained a line that has become almost ubiquitous now. You will see it on bumper stickers. Some women have it as a tattoo. It's on posters and buttons and all over Twitter. Here's the line. Well-behaved women seldom make history. The author of that line was a historian named Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. That paper, published in 1976, did not necessarily go viral at the time, as the saying goes. It wasn't until 1995 that a journalist named Kay Mills used it as an epigraph for her work of history on American women from Pocahontas to power suits. One year later, 1996, a woman in Oregon requested permission to print that slogan, "Well-behaved women seldom make history," on T-shirts. And boy, 20 years later, that slogan is everywhere. Sometimes you'll see it printed as, "Well-behaved women rarely make history," but the meaning is the same. And the woman who wrote those words is my guest in studio for the hour. And to be fair to Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, she's known for a lot more than just that slogan. She won the Pulitzer Prize in History in 1991, along with a pile of other awards and honors. She's a MacArthur Fellow. She's the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard. And Ulrich is in Rochester today for an event this evening at the University of Rochester's Rush-Reese Libraries, titled Curiosities, and we're going to be telling you about history and odd things and a 120-year-old tortilla of all things. That's at 5 p.m. tonight, but first, she's our guest here, and Laurel, it is our honor to have you. Thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
1976, you knew, didn't you, that you were writing a slogan that was just going to be all over the place?
Oh, yeah. If only I had copyrighted it, you know.
How much money did you fail to make off that?
Oh, I have no idea. But the world is better, you know, because of it.
It really is everywhere. And I was saying to Laurel before the program began, especially in the last year, you see it in so many places. You saw it in the Women's March in Washington on January 20th. And perhaps the events of the last year have led to more interest in just that slogan alone. But you know, I know you've done this a million times, and we won't spend the hour on it. But just tell me the story as you remember it from 1995, when it comes back to prominence here. I mean, it was 19 years after you used
right.
it in that article.
Right. When this young woman wrote me and said, "I want permission to use something that you said." And I thought to myself, did I say that? I mean, it took me a while to remember.
Sure.
It was actually my first scholarly article. I'd written a few things before, but I was a graduate student, and it started out as a seminar paper. So encouragement to all those students out there writing seminar papers. But it came back because I think the women's movement of the 70s took off. And a younger generation were working on a different set of issues at the time. And, the internet
mm-hmm.
spread it. So pretty soon it's very much in the public domain. I never had any control over it, but I still get emails sometimes from people saying, would it be all right? In fact, recently, I got one from the producer of a sitcom. Would it be all right if we had this bumper sticker on the set? And I think to myself, I mean, I have no control over that. But I appreciated, you know.
Is that nice?
They asked me. It's a nice feeling. As I've written, I finally wrote a book with that as the title to sort of reclaim the multiple meanings that mm-hmm. are attached to it, because they're pretty varied.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about that this hour. We're going to get to her presentation
yeah.
tonight coming up here. We'll hit some recent events, all with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. And I think you're right. Without the internet, maybe that doesn't pick up the velocity that it has in bouncing all across the culture. But I think it was also fascinating in reading parts of the book, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, reading the New York Times highlighting in particular the story of Rosa Parks,
mm-hmm.
the story that maybe most of us don't know about Rosa Parks and how there was almost a casting of someone for that role. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting example. I mean, we think of her as the seamstress whose feet were tired and she didn't want to walk to the back of the bus. And then, you know, she started the Montgomery bus boycott and the civil rights movement rolls on. But what we don't know about that story, or at least most of the general public didn't know, is that she had been working for years in the NAACP and other organizations. She'd been trained as an organizer. She'd been part of a community of activists who were trying to find the right kind of court case that could put their cause before the public. So she was well-behaved. I mean, she was well-spoken, well-dressed, hard-working, upright person. And because of that, she wasn't subject to a lot of pushback and scandal. But she wasn't just a simple woman going about her day.
Yeah, and that doesn't diminish from Rosa Parks or her place in history or the true injustice that existed at the time. It's just interesting in the context of the fact that it could have been other women, other people in that role, and yet some were viewed as too controversial, right?
Absolutely. So lots of people refused to go to the back of the bus, and some of them ended up in jail. This was a case where they knew they could get public attention because she was widely respected. She stepped out of line. She stepped out of her persona, you know, as a well-behaved woman, and therefore she was heard.
And so let me read from the New York Times, and we'll see if the author agrees with their characterization. They wrote,
yeah,
"The celebrated Rosa Parks didn't happen onto the stage of American history, but was cast for her myth-ready appeal. The president of the Montgomery, Alabama NAACP interviewed women arrested for refusing to give up their bus seats, rejecting unusable candidates," as Laurel's been telling you, by the way. And the New York Times goes on to say, "Then they found Parks, whose stainless reputation made her suitable for championing a cause. Parks's good behavior was as necessary as her bad, itself confined to voicing her refusal to comply with segregation. As Hillary Clinton well knows, to claim an audience is to submit to muckraking. And while an expose can enhance the career of an Amy Winehouse or a Paris Hilton, it can halt political aspirations. It behooves an ambitious woman to be judicious in her misbehavior," end quote. That's a strong last line, but do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with that politically, and I was just at the Susan B. Anthony House today, in fact. I had never been there.
Wow.
And thinking about the great Rochester woman who led for many, many years the cause of women's rights and women's suffrage, I mean, she was politically savvy. And the tour guide, as we were talking about it, said she sometimes wanted to, tear her hair because her companion and compatriot, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, really, as they got close to really making a difference in the suffrage movement, wanted to push them to the radical edge. And Susan B. Anthony realized if they were ever going to get this constitutional amendment for women's votes, they had to build a coalition. So there's a time and a place for radicalism. I mean, Susan B. Anthony went to jail for trying to vote early on. But
1872, yeah.
Yeah, to make a difference in the public sphere, at least, we need to learn how to work together and unite.
And I'm not sure, I want to make sure I understand, if you're saying that that's just the reality as opposed to what should be the reality. In other words, you know, the way women are sort of treated by society, there is sort of a game to play, unfortunately, if you want to be an effective activist.
I don't think it's a game. I think it's a part of a democratic process.
But isn't that unfair to women? Men don't get judged.
Oh, no. Men get judged, too.
Okay.
But we can talk about on what topics and what aspects, but I think in general, the do you want to talk about what happens to men? I mean, it's an interesting question. Women have, and minorities of all kinds, have a really difficult time because they don't inherit status. They have to kind of push against their presumed inherent role in the case of women, which is to be nice, to be gentle, to be nurturing, to be maternal.
To be childbearers.
And to be childbearers,
yeah,
and healers. So for a long time, after women won the right to vote, the role was to be nonpartisan. You know, the League of Women Voters, nonpartisan. We clarify the issues. We keep politics clean. We don't really go out and fight for a cause. But I think it takes all kinds of people to make a democracy. And we need the Elizabeth Cady Stantons to push the edge. And we need the Susan B. Anthonys. And we need the people like Carrie Chapman Catt, who could, you know, become friends with legislators and make things happen.
I think Laurel corrected me. I mean, it's not that men don't get judged. That's not what I intended to say. I think she said it much better than I did. Men sort of have, just based on power structures, status that is less earned and more inherent, as opposed to people of color, women often. And so that's why Rosa Parks has to sort of be chosen carefully to be the person in that role.
Yes,
as opposed to something happening more organically.
Right.
If it's a woman, particularly a woman of color. Fascinating stuff. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is our guest for the hour. The woman who coined the phrase, well-behaved women seldom make history, from a paper she was writing in 1976. 19 years later, that phrase gets picked up by a journalist, and now here we are 41 years later, and you see it everywhere. How often do people ask you or think, well, that had to be Susan B. Anthony, or maybe it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton? Who are the names that people assume coined that phrase and not you?
Marilyn Monroe has been on
the
list.
That's a lot, yep.
Eleanor Roosevelt. I can't remember.
Certainly Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady
Stanton. Yeah, it's certainly those, yeah.
But it was, and it was our guest for the hour, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. And now we even see that, you see it in song lyrics, and you tell this great story about how back when Garrison Keillor, I say back, but times have changed, when he hosted Prairie Home Companion, there was a band, and what's the band's name? You write about them in the book, and you've told the story about how they have those wonderful song lyrics that I have here. Oh, it's the Sweet Potato Queens.
Oh, yes.
The Sweet Potato Queens, and Casey Jones performed on Prairie Home Companion and sang lyrics that riffed off of Laurel's work. Do you remember what the lyrics are? Because I've got them.
You've got them.
I'm going to read them. Here's from that song. Now, I've been getting in trouble ever since I was a child. Mama told me girls like you turn into women that run wild. But if I didn't do what I'd done, I'd never have had so much fun. And Mama, life's too short to live it any other way. Well-behaved women don't drink shots and beers. That's why well-behaved women bore us all to tears. They're politically correct, but we invite them to defect because well-behaved women rarely make history.
Yes, and the Sweet Potato Queens invited me to come and be in their parade, and I didn't go, but I thank them. And the funny thing about this accidental slogan is it can be used in so many different ways. It's the ambiguity, probably, of the sentence that made it go viral. I'm kind of excited that what's happening right now is really focusing a lot on politics and about standing up for women's rights. But I think there was a period along this long trajectory where the version, the Sweet Potatoes Queen version, which is fun, it's about, it's Mae West. It's the woman who's outrageous, who's sexually explicit, who's raucous, who drinks with the boys. And it's a classic comic character and long-term stereotype of certain kind of women in theater and popular culture. But that's not really what I was talking about.
Yes.
What I was talking about, in truth, was neither of those things, neither political activism nor being wild. I was talking about the fact that historians have a very narrow interest, that they always wanted to write about rebels. And I don't think that's only true for women, but I think it's particularly true for women. Because women who just did women's things seem to be unchanging. History is a study of change, and if you think mothers have always been mothers and we love mother and apple pie, and therefore there's nothing to say, then there's no history. And the actual paragraph that I began that article in said something like, they went to church even when it snowed. You know, they read the Bible through once a year. They didn't ask to be remembered, and they haven't been. Well-behaved women seldom make history. But then I went on to say, hey, but they should make history, because women's lives haven't been unchanging. And the problem here is that historians haven't paid enough attention to the daily lives of ordinary people and women in particular. So I was making an argument for women's history.
It wasn't, and it shouldn't just be the rebels, as you said.
It should definitely include the rebels, absolutely. But, you know, I was writing in the 70s when the mode of writing history was history from the bottom up. And I was talking about all the forgotten women of early New England, which was my subject matter on my dissertation. And how can we rediscover their lives? Mm. We could rediscover them in court records, which I did, and I used extensively. Women who decided not to go to church, you know, every Sunday. But we could also discover them in other places. And eventually, I happened upon a really fabulous diary where a woman who was a midwife wrote about her own life. And those are the best kinds of sources, when women tell about themselves and leave records that maybe they thought were humdrum or daily, but that in retrospect turn out to be very powerful interventions in history.
And won a Pulitzer Prize for it.
Yes.
I always like to ask Pulitzer winners if you saw it coming. Most people don't publish with the expectation of winning a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh no. In fact, I remember the day that this prize was announced, which was a total shock, a reporter from the New York Times called, and he said something like, well, tell me how your work has transformed history. And I said, oh, well, I never thought about that. I just thought of, you know, I was filling in something that was missing in history. And he said to me, I think you're going to have to get over that. And it was very interesting. You know, I thought about that a lot, whether it's good to anticipate that you're doing something that's going to get a lot of attention or not. Because I really thought the book was a failure. I couldn't imagine the general reading public wanting to follow me through the meanderings of the 27-year-long diary of an early American woman. And the reaction to it taught me a lot about what matters to people and what matters in history.
And you have, I think, a very interesting take on what history actually is. As a historian yourself, I don't want to misquote you, and I'll let you kind of expound, but essentially, History is not just what happened. It's also in what we choose to remember or choose to report of it. And if we either change history as it's popularly reported, it becomes history whether we like it or not, or if we leave things out or don't know.
Right. Right? It's a constant dialogue between present and past. I mean, things happen in the past, but we only know about what gets recorded. And lots of things get recorded that nobody cares about. So, for example, my midwife's diary, lots of people had looked at it and said it's filled with trivia. You know, who cares? Well, I was really interested because I'd labored in over a first book where I could learn about the lives of women from what other people said about them. But I had almost nothing in their own voice. And so I did care about this. And so I saw it as worthwhile.
And doesn't, I would assume that this just bolsters the common perception. I mean, it's hard to argue that those in power tend to write the history.
That's right. And those who write the history also sometimes are empowered. I mean, the Susan B. Anthony story, again, it's so fresh in my mind having visited the house today. But there's a wonderful room on the top of the house that has a double desk. So two people could work at once facing each other, a typewriter, imagine that. Late 19th century, a typewriter on each side, and just a sense these people have tried to change history through political action, and they have a sense that they're going to change it. The National Amendment hasn't yet passed, but they're busy writing themselves into the nation's history by creating a history of the women's suffrage movement as it's happening. And that was pretty exciting.
What was it like for you to visit the house for the first time today?
I actually was very moved. And particularly with that upstairs attic room and the sense of energy that of women who knew that what they had been doing was going to matter to somebody and therefore they took the time to write it.
And here we are now in the last year or so, particularly in 2017, a lot of commentary, and really since Harvey Weinstein, that this is the year that the women struck back, that women who have been harassed, abused, sexually mistreated for years and had to live with that in some way, either because no one would believe them or because based on existing power structures, they felt they couldn't speak. Well, they're speaking. Even today, I don't know if listeners have caught up to the news on Senator Al Franken, whose career is in jeopardy for some of his past actions. And he's already issued an apology. I wonder what you make of that and if you think this is a real change moment in our culture.
One of the things I never do is predict the future.
Yes, I mean, historian who looks at the past, I'm asking you to look ahead.
We look over our shoulder.
Sure.
But I have, of course, I'm pleased that women are energized. I'm very impressed that women are energized and very depressed at how pervasive this behavior is. And my honest feeling about it is, here we go again. You know, I felt we were there in the 80s. The legislation on sexual harassment was created out of an energetic women's movement. And, you know, the question is, did we forget? How did this change? Did we grow complacent? I think the issue is that there are so many more women today, partly because of what my generation of women were able to pioneer, who are in the workplace they're in the workplace at levels they have never been before, and they're ambitious and ready to move up. They're not home, and therefore maybe we have ignored this terrible dynamic, which entangles people in the question of I'm going to hang on to this job, which I need and which I want, and does that mean I'm going to submit to this boss? It's not so great, but it's a very long story in women's history, and I do hope maybe we're getting to the point where women and men are not going to stand for it.
Sure, and I think especially in terms of power structures in politics, one of the great challenges will be to find out if we can get past our political tribalism and embrace whatever standards we choose to have about these issues, no matter the party. I think today's swift reaction to the news on Senator Al Franken shows that maybe, at least for this moment, and I want to believe it's becoming more permanent, maybe that's happening. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not happening in Alabama with Judge Roy Moore, but Al Franken's career is in jeopardy now, and there are calls for him to resign from very prominent voices in Democratic and left-leaning media. Forget the fact that he's a popular Democrat. So that I would think we've got to transcend tribalism to the point where we don't tolerate this, no matter the party. We don't have sort of rationalization, or we don't do sort of the apology for someone just because they're in the political party, that we will hold true to that standard. And if we get there, maybe that's the moment we can say something changed. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons why some Republicans are not supporting Moore. They didn't support him before the revelations. And so you want to believe that's really genuine, that it's the concern about abuse that's calling them to pull away. And I do hope Democrats face the same issue in their own party and are willing to stand up.
We shall see. I want to grab one phone call before we, in our second half hour, we're going to talk about what our guest for the hour, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, is going to be presenting tonight at the University of Rochester, 5 p.m., free public event at the Rush Reese Library. We'll get to that in a moment, but let me grab Barbara on the line first. Go ahead, Barbara.
There, it's thrilling to hear your voice in person. As you say, you know, your phrase has been all over the place, including on bumper stickers at the Susan B. House. And it's delightful to know that you went there because, as you said, it's so moving. And no matter how many times you go there, it's every time it's moving all over again. And I wanted to comment on how important I thought it was that you spoke to the issue of a simple woman, unquote. And I'm thinking a book title could be In Praise of the Simple Woman, because in fact, we're all simple women until we're not. And that's, I'm sure, you know, you can't speak for the dead. That's anathema for historians. But I'm in my heart believe Susan felt that she indeed was a simple Quaker woman who paid attention to her inner light and went forward, and the rest is history, thank God.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to thank you for that. And then quickly, I just wanted to add in two quick little points. Anthony did not, in fact, go to jail. She was arrested and all of that, that whole long story, but she did not spend any time in jail. And secondly, the League of Women Voters, while they, of course, maintain neutrality as much as they can, they do, in fact, fight for certain issues. So I just wanted to add those two little things.
No, those are good clarifications. Thank you.
Barbara, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Listeners, if you want to call the program, we're going to be talking about a number of issues for the rest of the hour with our guest. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You might have heard Barbara just mention the slogan that's everywhere. And if you're just tuning in, you're saying, wait, what's the slogan? It's well-behaved women seldom make history. That's how it was originally constructed. Sometimes you see it presented as well-behaved women rarely make history, roughly the same meaning. Laurel doesn't seem to mind either way, right?
No.
Fair enough. She's a historian, Pulitzer Prize winner. She's at Harvard now, many, many books and awards, prizes over the years. She is in Rochester today because she is going to be presenting tonight at the University of Rochester's Rush Reese Library. So let's get our only break of the hour, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about, what is it, 120-year-old tortilla?
Yeah.
What else would we talk about? We'll talk about that and a lot more with Laurel next. Let me tell you what's coming up Friday on The Next Connections. A documentary called Backpack Full of Cash explores how different cities have privatized their schools and the impact that move has had on the public schools. We'll discuss what happened in Philadelphia and New Orleans and talk vouchers, the impact on public school funding, and the effort to create schools that work well for all students, whether it's Rochester, Philadelphia, New Orleans, or wherever the case may be. That's Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Mark emails the program and says, Evan, I'm sorry, but Republicans will always protect Republicans. Democrats will always protect Democrats. That's politics. That's always been politics. This is not a moment of change. Thank you, Mark. But let me just say that in the last hour, after the revelations about Senator Al Franken this morning, and again, I'm not going to recount all of that. You can find it on NPR.org and many other sources. Here's Senator Claire McCaskill, very prominent voice in the Democratic Party. She tweets, regarding Al Franken, I'm shocked and concerned. The behavior described is completely unacceptable. Comedy is no excuse for inappropriate conduct, and I believe there should be an ethics investigation. Tim Kaine, former vice presidential candidate, former Virginia governor, longtime Virginia senator. Tim Kaine comes out and says, I believe that what he has done is wrong, period. So that's two very prominent Democrats, and those are the first I just happened to see in the last 5 minutes. So, Mark, I understand your feeling that politics is so tribal that in regards to the treatment of women in powerful quarters in our society, maybe we'll never get past that, but maybe we are. Maybe we are right now. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is my guest, and tonight she has a presentation that you can attend at 5 p.m. It's called Curiosities, History in Odd Things. It's part of the Humanity Center's lecture series, and she's looked at the history through objects, so she is going to be presenting 5 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library. You can go tonight. What's the story behind this tortilla?
Well, I don't want to tell the whole story.
You can't give it all away. But give us a taste of the tortilla.
Yeah, the story basically is for 10 or 12 years, I've been trying to get Harvard students out of their cell phones and their, you know, whatever electronic device they're using, and pay attention to the things around them, including the amazing collections in Harvard University's museums. So a number of years ago, some colleagues and I said, let's find some really cool stuff and put it on display. We found some really cool stuff. But one of the ones that blew us away was, at the time, I think it was a 116-year-old tortilla. It's gotten older each time I talk about it. Collected in the 1890s in Mexico, brought to Harvard University, stored in the herbaria, the collection of botanic specimens at Harvard, lurking there, unseen, unappreciated, unknown, you know, kind of like a well-behaved woman. Nobody noticed. And we noticed. And it's been a lot of fun to get students engaged in writing the history and understanding the history of this strange little cake.
The students, even at Harvard, are buried in their cell phones?
Yeah, they are.
When it comes to historical objects, I wonder if, similarly to how you look at the way history kind of looks at rebels and will tell the history of rebels, especially when it comes to the stories of women, but maybe not the women who were not as rebellious, lived day-to-day lives, but contributed to history nonetheless. In the same way that we overlook the mundane or basic objects, but that can also tell us a lot.
Yes.
What do you think?
You've expressed that perfectly. And a history of a water bottle that's sitting here on this desk, if we begin to look at it, where on earth did that come from? That we're walking around carrying water in a plastic bottle. You know, there are some towns in my state where you can't buy water in a bottle for environmental reasons. But the whole question about where our water comes from, how it's delivered, what it means, is not just an environmental history, a contemporary political history. It's a historical. It's a historical issue as well, trying to understand the common lives of people in the past, what people wore, what people ate. Those are now new, cool, hot historical topics in the academy, I think because people in their own lives are becoming foodies. You know, it's not just recreation, but it's about the environment.
Yeah, I look at this water bottle that Laurel's talking about.
Yeah.
Some point in the far, hopefully far, far distant future, someone will pull out this water bottle and they'll say, wow, water was so abundant that they could just have it in bottles sitting around. They could dump it down the drain. And right now, it's offensive enough that we do that because there's people around the world in places barely have any, or have no clean drinking water. There was a New York State 5-cent deposit, and they'll say, oh, that's back before cryptocurrency was used by everybody. That's when physical money was used. Where did the water come from? What is this television radio it says on the front? What forms of communication were those? This is one little bottle of water, and Laurel has me thinking about how future historians.
Absolutely. Yeah. WXXI? Is that
No, that's forever. No one will have any question in the future about WXXI. I don't mean to correct you, but that will be around forever.
Okay.
In different forms, you know, yeah. Radio and television.
Yeah.
Who knows? Before I grab Carol in Rochester on the phone, Carol, stay there for one moment here. I just want to connect this to your Pulitzer winner, Midwife's Tale, because you talked about your own skepticism that who's going to care about this diary that goes over 27 years. But I have a fascination about how life was lived in different eras and particularly long ago times before the modern conveniences. And, you know, a friend of mine and I, we always joke that if Louis Couture's, woke up today in Rochester, New York, he'd say, you're all living better than French kings did for centuries, and yet you find things to complain about. So I find the fascination just with the rhythm of day-to-day life, and I find that important. And so I'm just glad that historians like you are working on that.
Absolutely. And the skills involved in living everyday life. I mean, how many of us know how to make the things we need? We know how to push buttons, but how do things happen?
How self-sufficient we are, or aren't anymore.
Yeah. No, people really weren't self-sufficient in the past. They were interdependent in different ways than we are, but they had a kind of physical, mechanical, manual engagement with the world that some of us have lost, because the virtual world is a lot of fun and it's kind of easy.
Let me grab another phone call. This is Carol in Rochester. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, Laura. Yes, we met, you don't remember me, I know, but we met 6 or 7 years ago at a women's history conference in Amherst, Massachusetts. Even though I live in Rochester, I'm with the Susan B. Anthony Birthplace Museum in Adams, Massachusetts.
Okay.
As soon as The Midwife's Tale came out, I mean, I think I had to be standing in line at Barnes & Noble because I could not wait to read it. There was nothing in that about abortion, which I was surprised about, because there was a letter or article in Susan B. Anthony's newspaper condemning the high rate of abortion in the state of Maine, which is where, of course, the history of The Midwife's Tale was told. My research has led me to the conclusion that the suffragists opposed abortion, and I wondered if you could confirm that or deny that, because I was really surprised when I read about the Handmaid's Tale. Yes.
Well, this is going to be one of those things that people hate about historians. We're always talking about dates. So Martha Ballard's diary, 1785 to 1812. And Susan B. Anthony was born in 1820, but lived a very, very long time into the early 20th century. So we're talking about two totally different eras. And the whole notion of limiting the size of a family that was accomplished by less sex, but it was also, there were abortions, there were eventually different kind of contraceptive measures, and those all developed pretty much after Martha Ballard's time. There were herbal remedies and so on, not very effective, but in a pioneer community in rural Maine, where Martha Ballard had her practice, there was an expectation of high fertility and a need in this early community for large families because, of course, many children died. So a midwife's tale is not relevant to your late 19th century argument that you're making. And my understanding is that many people opposed abortion in the 19th century, including many suffragists, because it was dangerous and people died. And it was also seen as a kind of stigmatization of the people who turned to that solution, often had been abused and mistreated. I have a hard time imagining those 19th century suffragists not having somewhat different ideas about how we solve the problem of abuse and the problems of family planning today. I mean, it's so easy to look in the past and want to pick our heroes and want to pick our solutions, but we have to contextualize in each period in order to understand what was said.
My brain is connecting a few things, and I'm curious to know your feelings as a historian on the idea of contextualization, because, you know, let's say, and the question on Susan B. Anthony on her views on reproductive health and abortion have been debated a lot. I know it's emotional for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But let's just say hypothetically that, as you say, suffragists, including Susan B. Anthony, let's say a document came out in which there was no ambiguity that she opposed abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, looking back at the time, it was a very dangerous practice. Very,
yes.
Very different than it is performed today. Again,
right.
As a host, I'm not sitting here endorsing, I'm just observing. It is a lot safer in terms of outcomes today than it was 100, 150 years ago.
As childbirth is.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. So, and yet, some people would choose to take a comment from a different era and try to apply it with today's context without that context. In the same ways that occasionally people will look at what is written about race, about other very sensitive issues. And what I want to avoid is I don't want to give someone a pass, no matter their era, for bigotry. I don't want to give someone a pass for not pursuing true equality and justice. And I'm sure my own actions in my own life can be reexamined. But I'm talking about historical figures, Civil War era, what did Lincoln say? What did Seward say? What was their view on eradicating slavery? How quickly did they want to accomplish it? Or think it could be versus others who had more urgency. And I'm curious to know as a historian how you choose to view context, language, the way people talked about others, equality, those sensitive issues from today's lens, and how careful you are maybe not to over-apply today's lens, or if you think there are some things that are universal and we should apply today's lens.
Well, I think ideally you want to interpret a situation in the context of the time in which it happened. Then the moral judgment comes personally in your own time. So we don't accept a racist comment from Abraham Lincoln and say because Abraham Lincoln was a racist, I'm going to be a racist, any more than we would take an anti-abortion comment from a time and say because that person was anti-abortion, I'm going to be anti-abortion. Do you see what I'm saying? We have to make moral judgments ourselves and take responsibility for them. We're not writing history to create heroes and to create models. We're writing history to create understanding of how human beings in particular circumstances dealt with the dilemmas of their own time and place. And so, you know, I mean, we could go on and on about that. I mean, we're fighting right now over Civil War monuments. And I think the issue there is that the monuments, that some monuments that people want to tear down, I think rightly so, were erected explicitly to not to celebrate a Civil War soldier, but to sustain a particular form of injustice that persists into the present. And some of those monuments, not all, some have been used to validate a kind of ignorance of contemporary issues. Yeah. So the issue is, what is the issue today? And what is the relation? Now, the U.S. Constitution is a problem because it both lays down principles of justice, and I'm talking about as it's ratified in 1789, it lays down principles of justice that have transformed people's lives for generations. It also lays down a system of injustice that made people's lives miserable. And we don't throw out the Constitution, we amend it. We change our contemporary practice. We don't wipe out the past or our understanding of it.
I never understand the argument that if you tear down the monuments, you're erasing history. We've got lots of ways to understand history.
Oh, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah. And the monuments are a history of an attempt to use the Civil War to deal with something in the present. And that's the difference.
Before we lose the hour with Pulitzer Prize winner Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who is in Rochester for an event tonight, before the hour's out, I'll let you know how you can see her tonight. But before we lose that, I want to ask you about something you said about growing up and thinking about becoming a writer. I know you kind of describe yourself as coming from a family of readers and debaters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you went to college, you studied English and journalism. And you said, nobody ever encouraged me or mentored me, and I hardly ever read a woman writer. You said, I have to be honest, that in the 1950s, nobody was encouraging women to go to grad school. But you were the valedictorian of a large state university, and you're looking at the landscape, and it was not common to do certain things. Are you feeling, in terms of how you would evaluate whatever you would call progress, are you feeling good that is not the case anymore, and do you see more ways to go there?
Oh, it's tremendous opportunities for people today that did not exist in the 1950s. We have our own problems, though. And so successes and transformations create new problems. And one of the big issues for me is, and this is in my mind a women's history issue, if we create the world according to a model once applied to men about the company is always right and you're married to the company no matter how many hours you spend, are we going to have personal lives and are we going to have families left? And so there's an area where I really think men and women both need to be less well-behaved and begin to insist upon space for things in life that aren't just about money.
We're going to lose the hour in just a second, so Laurel's going to remind you about why she's here. Tonight, 5 p.m. at the University of Rochester in the Hawkins Carlson Room at the Rush Reese Library. It's a free event called Curiosities, History in Odd Things. It's part of the Humanity Center's public lecture series, and you've got a chance to hear a Pulitzer Prize winner tonight at 5 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library. What's the brief preview that you can give the audience?
Well, the brief preview is history is fun, and we all do it. We do it every day in our lives, and let's do it more with more fun and more imagination.
It's going to be great fun tonight. By the way, you know, you win a Pulitzer for Midwife's Tale. You've got this diary, and it comes from a very different time. Here we are today. You've got students at Harvard who can't get off their phones, and they're ostensibly communicating, but people are rarely writing letters like we used to. We're rarely expressing ourselves in long form. As a historian, does that concern you for future historians who want to understand us?
Well, the librarians are trying to figure out how to mine websites. I don't know what, you know, print your email. But I suppose we have an awful lot of visual information, if it survives, you know, from pre-birth all the way through our lives, and that we may have to learn to use different kinds of sources.
Yeah. Future historians are going to have a different job. It's going to be very interesting. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, author of a number of books. The woman who coined the phrase, well-behaved women seldom make history. That was back in 1976. Now you see it everywhere. Now you know the voice and the person behind that phrase. Great having you. Thank you for being so generous with your time today.
Glad to be here.
Tonight, 5 p.m., Rush Reese Library, University of Rochester. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we are right back here with you Friday on member-supported public radio.